Hey team, welcome to the Professionally Offensive Podcast. I'm your host, Joseph Cabrera. This is the spot where we provide raw, unfiltered insights from some amazing guests. Stand by, you're about to be offended in all the right ways. All right, team, welcome back. And I am here with Michael Gordon. And Michael Gordon, I'll give you his background here in a second, but it's just one of the, we just finished talking, I don't know, probably half an hour before we even kicked this episode on about everything from Willie Nelson to climbing mountains. And so some of these things I wish y'all could kind of tune into, but just all around, not only an epic entrepreneur and somebody who's just a really great leader in his space and other businesses run, just a, as we would say in the service, just a good dude. And so, Michael, thank you for spending some time with us today and chatting with us and, hey, you know, learning from you.
I appreciate it. It's fun to be here. We're going to have a good time today.
Oh, I know. We're going to have a great time. So I got to kick off with something that, like, you are there, you know, you're back. Well, let me give the listeners a little bit of a basis of just who you are, fill in any gaps you want. But Michael's, over the course of his life, has had 14 plus different companies. Some of them, I'm sure, that range from, you know, not so great to really, really great. And I know you've talked about this ad nauseum. And so I, you know, love that. Has been a true pioneer with him and his team in the teledoc or telemedicine space. And that's something we're going to dive into here as well. But I think what's interesting, we're just talking about in the, as it references to mountains, there's very few things in the world that you can pioneer anymore, especially in the space of business. And so this is one where it's epic that him and his team have really been able to carve out, you know, this, I think it's a $250 billion industry that, you know, really didn't even exist before you guys kind of got your hands on it. And I know there's some history behind that, so I'm looking forward to talking about that. And then just when you meet good entrepreneurs, the one thing that we were also sharing before the show is that there's just a unique aura, and I am absolutely biased on this, but there's a unique aura about Texas entrepreneurs. And they're just, they're equally hard-hitting and approachable at the same time. That you have this air, and you're not shy of that personality at all, but you have this air about you that's like, hey, I'm willing to help you, let me know how we can, but once I'm done doing that, I got to go knock some things out, you know. And so I know that you being a part of the, you know, Texas Business Hall of Fame and being a director there and giving back and all those things have been a big part of who and what you do on a daily basis. But I know that's kind of the Cliff Notes version of a very long, you know, and successful career there. But any key things that I missed there, Michael? I know that you probably got things you could talk for days.
Yeah. Let's skip all the boring stuff and get down to the fun.
You know? Sounds good. Yeah, we can do that. I want to kick off talking about entrepreneurship. This podcast is often, we talk to entrepreneurs and folks that are in the, you know, in the space of starting new things. And it's always an interesting breed of person. And in my experience, as I talk to entrepreneurs, they all have certain things that drive them kind of similar. Something usually really intrinsic. They're very self-starters. There's all the basic objective things to make a great entrepreneur. They like to solve problems. Mm-hmm. But I've also noticed they all have their own style. And yeah. So being me and you were kind of into music and stuff, I think you can appreciate that like country music is country music, hip hop's hip hop. Mm-hmm. But within those genres, people just do it differently. And yeah. I noticed your style is unique. It is one that seems to be, have a large breadth about it. It's not, it doesn't seem super hyper-focused in the macro, but then at the same time, you just kind of have an interesting way and approachability about it. So can you talk to us a little bit about what that is and maybe where that comes from?
Yeah. Okay. So here's a great story. I'm a freshman starting in engineering school in this giant auditorium, and the dean is talking to all of us little snot-nosed kids. And one of the things he says, almost every one of you has heard it, look left, look right. Only one of you will be here at graduation. And so I look left, there's a valedictorian. I look right, there's a salutatorium. And I graduated number 32 in my class. And I'm like, holy blank. How am I going to get through this? And the thing that I had that I didn't realize, and the dean didn't say it, and everybody needs to know it, is persistence. And, you know, when the others got knocked down, so engineering school is really hard.
Yeah.
And the valedictorian who's used to acing and playing at the same time, first time he makes a D or an F on that physics test that's designed to give him a D or an F, he doesn't know what to do. And yeah. I'm just like, okay, I've been knocked down and kicked in the teeth. I'm going to get up, put a smile on, and go again. And but then I realized that these guys that graduated first in their class, they had a level of brains that I didn't have. And so the next thing that I learned was, it's not just going to be persistence and hard work. I got to surround myself with people who are smarter than me and listen to them. And so finding study groups, okay? And these are sort of the elements that you learn in college that when you translate them into the real world, what do you need to do as an entrepreneur to build a great company? First, you have to have a great plan. You got to surround yourself with people who are smarter than you. And you got to leave your ego at home and listen to the people around you. And what do you guys say in the military? The battle plan survives until the first shot is fired.
That's exactly right.
And so you got to be flexible.
Yep.
Right? And,
yeah.
And so kind of, those are kind of the things that I've learned and sort of polished over the years. You know, the persistence, the people, the plan.
I notice you focus on the, just in things that I've heard you talk about before and whatnot, you focus on the people quite a bit. And yeah. I even know that what you're doing right now with Recuro, you guys are looking a lot at talent, you know, a lot of the right players, which seems so, I feel like I'm saying, and listeners might be like, yeah, duh, but it's incredibly difficult, right? Not only to find the right folks, but to your point, have the humility to actually, cause I got to imagine, right, Magma, how did you in the early days decide to almost put your ego aside? Because it can seem, I would imagine, for a lot of entrepreneurs, kind of intimidating to go find people who are smarter than you.
Yeah. Well, I think ultimately, if you want success, then you've got to use the elements that get you to success. And I think that I did it unconsciously. You know, in engineering school, it was survival mode. And I took that sort of survival mode into the business world.
Yeah.
But in the 90s, I built a company called Internet Global. And somehow, I managed to convince a guy named Nathan Morton to be my mentor. And Nathan had been the man who created the business plan that got Target from a couple of stores to a major national and then later international brand.
Yeah.
And then he did the same thing again with Home Depot. And then he did the same thing again with CompUSA. And he had just come out of CompUSA.
This is a heavy hit.
And yeah, and I convinced him to mentor me at Internet Global. And when I left Internet Global, I had lunch with him. I was thinking about building Teladoc. And he said, Michael, the thing that you did at iGlobal was you took people who were B minus, B plus caliber workers, and you turned them into A plus. And he said, now you can bring the A pluses in, and what will you be able to do with them? And he said, it's all about inspiring them and making them believe in and own a piece of the dream. And, you know, oh, I could tell stories all day about Teladoc because, should I?
What, please.
Okay,
yeah,
so
I think it's worth now. I mean, that, you kind of open the kimono
right.
on that.
So,
yeah.
You know, in the reason why telemedicine was so difficult wasn't because it was a new idea. Jay Sanders, you know, had been pushing the idea since 1967. It wasn't because nobody knew how to do the technology. It was because there was bureaucratic resistance.
Makes
and,
sense.
You know, I don't know how many times at Teladoc I got told by powers that could do it that if I built this company, I would go to prison. And, I mean, imagine it now. I mean, telemedicine is just part of our day-to-day life.
Oh, my God, it's on the app on my phone. Yeah, right.
But I'm sitting in my office, and I'm at the end of a very long hallway, well into the Teladoc era. And I'm in a meeting, and my admin comes in. And she says, I need you up front. And I look at her, and I'm like, Ruthie, you know, I'm in a meeting, and she whispers in my ear, the DEA is here with guns and badges.
Wait, that, really?
Yes. And I'm like, okay. So, you know, this is kind of a fun story, but I want it to be right now, I want it to be a corporate culture story.
Yep.
And so now think about it. I'm at the end of a long hallway. I'm the last one in the building to know the DEA is here with guns and badges. And so now imagine every single person. You could be one of those people. What are you thinking? Do you want to go home in handcuffs today? Or not go home, but go somewhere in handcuffs? No. And so what everybody should have been thinking is, my kid's sick. I got to go home. I'm going to go, you know, I don't belong here. But nobody did. Not a single soul stood down.
Why was it?
And
what do you think?
Okay. One of my favorite stories from history. You know this story. Because your military background is the 300,
yeah.
Right? So what did Leonidas do? How did he get 300 people? You know, when those Persians let those arrows go, There were 300,000 arrows and then another 300,000. What they told Leonidas is there will be so many arrows in the air coming towards your 300 guys that it will black out the sun. You know what Leonidas said?
We'll fight in the dark.
We'll fight in the shade. Yeah. You got it. You got it. And so, you know, but why? I have a personal story. You know, when I was an undergrad, I was in archery. And as a senior, I was helping coach the freshman that took archery as a PE class.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of them put that arrow and let it go straight up.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay. So, you know, I'm a scientist. I know what goes up must come down.
Yes.
And when it comes down, it's going to come down at kind of the same rate it went up. And you can't see it. You just know it's going to come down. You don't know how long it's going to be, a few seconds, you know. But, you know, and now I've got all these freshmen scattered all over this field. And I'm just thinking, this is the end of life. You know, somebody's going to get killed. We never found that arrow.
Really?
But just that 30 seconds of terror, not knowing where the arrow was going to land. And now imagine 2,000 arrows per person. That is the 300, the 600, or the 600,000 arrows that are coming from two flights from the Persians.
That's right.
And that's got to be terrifying. But nobody ran because Leonidas picked people who understood the difference between what is the opposite of fear? Why would you not be scared? Because you're defending something behind you.
You matter.
Yep. You know, you joined the U.S. military and you knew your love of country, that which stood behind you, meant I will never run. And that worked that day at Teladoc. Everybody knew what we stood for. Everybody knew that they owned a piece of this and they believed in it.
Yeah.
And it didn't matter that the DEA was there with guns and badges. We were doing the right thing and nobody ran. And, you know, as a leader, it's got to be one of your most proud moments.
Oh,
you know,
my God. I mean, thank God something like that happened probably, right?
Yeah.
I mean, just to really test the gumption. And I can only... They knew what it probably, I bet you looking back on it now, I bet you as you run into some of your old teammates on that stuff, I bet you they're like, yeah, we probably knew something like this was getting, what we were doing, you know, we knew the risks, you know, awesome. I mean, I can't, when did you guys get them out of your office at some point? Did you have to stop work or?
Well, they believed that we were writing prescriptions for narcotics, which we weren't.
Yeah.
And they told us, we're going to take every file apart. We're going to find where you're doing it and you're going to go to prison. And, but we weren't. And it took them 3 months. So the great ending to that story is the guy who led the investigation was grumpy. He was in our office all the time. He was just not nice to anybody. And I came in one morning, he's sitting there and he goes, you office now. And so now I'm doing the reverse walk of that, you know, and I'm going down the hall and everybody's going, oh no, poor Michael's going to go off to prison today. And he comes in, he closes the door and he sits down and he goes, we love Teladoc.
Really?
Uh-huh. He said, I got agents all over the country. They get sick. We don't know what to do. And we see you guys are doing the right thing. We need to join.
No sweat. I mean, really, Ken, that's unreal.
Yeah. So, you know, there's nothing in the world better than turning a negative into a positive, right?
Well, and you know, as a true blue entrepreneur, like, you don't want the book written any other way.
No.
You don't want to be like, and then we did this and it was perfectly accepted and everybody loved it and no hiccups. Like, you want that story. I know it's a weird thing, but you want that story.
I could have been writing the story from prison.
I guess I would have made it just a tinge better, right? And then when I got out,
it wouldn't have made it better.
So tell me about, since we're on it, I know you had mentioned, you know, that this, you know, I'm impressed with the fact that out of the many businesses that you've had, you know, from and have, healthcare is one that I'm always like, God bless, man, whoever's even trying to do that. We know we need the help, but at the same time, it is such a behemoth. Mm-hmm. I know earlier on you were mentioning that, you know, yes, we're pioneering some stuff, but this was actually started back in the 60s, I think you said.
Right. Yeah,
tell me a little bit about that journey and then how you kind of, so to speak, picked the baton up and just ran with it.
So, you know, when I, Teladoc started climbing a mountain. Dr. Brooks, who was my lifelong adventure buddy, I had just sold a company for $100+ million. I called a bunch of friends and said, I'm going to go climb Kilimanjaro. I'll pay all your training, all your gear, all your travel if you want to come with me. So I put together a team of five, and Dr. Brooks was one of them. And so,
that's a great gift, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean, you could have done a yacht or something, but that's awesome.
It's Byron Brooks is an electrical engineer, MD. And, you know, he saw how his friend had gone from rags to riches and built something amazing in Internet Global. And he was convinced that we were going to find a way to build the next thing. That became Teladoc. And so, you know, but again, over and over and over, it is, what are the elements? Because I had come out of an internet company, and before that, an international trade company.
Yeah.
So they're all different. But the reality is, the elements are the same. Smart people, surround yourself, listen to them, dream big. Everybody owns a piece of it. And every time you get knocked down and kicked in the teeth, put a smile on and go again.
But then, yeah, so moving into that, all decided that, okay, I'm going to, that idea permeated from, like, y'all were literally just climbing up Killy, and y'all were like, you remember this guy back in the day in the 60s? I mean, how did transpire?
So Byron actually was working at NASA, he was a officer in the Air Force Reserves,
okay,
with the title flight surgeon. So his goal was to be an astronaut, but flight surgeons take care of people remotely.
Yep.
And so he's in his office one day, and the state of Texas had passed a law that said if an inmate in a correctional facility requests a doctor, we have to bring them a doctor in 24 hours. And so University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston was trying to figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Brooks was there as a Air Force flight surgeon, and he heard them talking about it. And so he's like, goes next door, and he goes, well, here's how you can do this. You know, I'm an engineer and I'm MD. And so he started showing them. And so that's how he got involved prior to climbing Kilimanjaro. And so he was thinking about that. And when we were climbing Killy, the thing that he was saying was, we need to build a telemedicine company. So I knew nothing about telemedicine. Came back, did the homework, and I discovered Jay Sanders. So Jay is a young medical school grad at Mass General. And his professor, so Mass General, Boston. Right? 1967. Anybody who's been in Boston knows traffic is a nightmare. Now there's a tunnel that we, the taxpayers, paid for, you know, that goes all over the place under Boston. And you can get from Mass General over to Logan Airport relatively easily. But back then, you were up on street level with tourists darting everywhere and, you know, traffic lights and nightmare, right? Yeah. So his professor has to go to Logan Field every day and treat patients and then come back to Mass General. And so one hot summer day, he's just comes back in, he's red-faced, and he's like, I got to fix this. And I got this idea. And Jay, the young, you know, med student who's just graduated, his professor is saying yes, and he describes, you know, putting cameras and TV, and Jay thinks to himself, this is the stupidest idea I have ever heard of, but this is my professor, so yep, we'll do it. All right. And so he goes from this is the stupidest idea to getting it built, and then, you know, carrying the banner right up until we built Teladoc. And so all the stories, you know, all the things he saw along the way, it was a great epiphany. And that is, why is telemedicine so effective? So he tells this story in the early days. They're doing a telemedicine consult, and there's a lady sitting in a chair that's all torn up, and he can see, you know, the fibers inside the chair, probably outgassing. And
yeah,
she's got a cat in her lap, and her husband is behind her smoking, and she's doing a telemedicine consult and complaining about allergies. and Jay goes, wow, this woman has been into all these different doctors. They've never figured it out. And he's looking into her house and seeing three major causes for allergies. And he's like, okay, we know how to do this. And so that sort of epiphany, why is telemedicine so good? Take the healthcare into the home of the patient. If you can see into their home, into their environment, you'll see things you'll never get in that 3 seconds you have with them in the office.
You're adding a ton of context to that patient, right? And it's good for both sides, though, right?
Yes, like
it is. I thought about this even on my way drive up from Austin. It just kind of clicked in my brain. Not for the first time, but kind of solidified because I knew he was talking to you. I was like, it's not just a righteously good for the patient.
Yeah.
It's really daggone good for the doctor, too, right?
Oh, it's financially. Okay, think about this. If you go see your doctor, you're going to pay $110 for that visit.
Right.
When we built Teladoc, you'd pay $35 for that visit. Guess which doctor makes more? The telemedicine doctor makes more. And because, okay, so now let's mentally walk into the doctor's office, right? We're a sick patient. We walk in there. What do we see? A room with sick people, magazines, couches. There's an admin with a telephone system and computers and networked all the way back and nurses and rooms and doctors and all that, right? So that $110 is paying all of those expenses, right? In the telemedicine consult.
Internet connection.
Okay, so the average doctor when we started Teladoc was working 60 to 70 hours a week and making $148,000 a year.
Okay.
When we got Teladoc going, the average doctor could take 40 hours a week, take a month of vacation, 4 weeks of vacation, and make $250. So living a normal lifestyle, being able to spend time with the patient, listen to the patient, interact with them, make more money than they could running the practice because they're not paying all those expenses.
Absolutely.
The $35 is covers their med mal, and what else is there?
Yeah.
You know, we do their accounting, we do everything for them. And so what we did, so the doctors loved it. And guess what happened? It became a race. So my favorite state was Florida because there were a couple doctors in Florida that were always competing for each other. So the way a patient got served was they would call our call center. The call center would put them into a queue and it would send a notice out to the doctors. Back then it was with pagers.
Oh,
now
yeah.
It's with cell phones, right? So the doctors would get paged and they would say, okay, there's a patient in the queue. They'd go log onto their computer. Fastest doctor wins. Right? And that's really important.
It is.
Fastest doctor wins. And so what ends up happening is in the beginning of Teladoc, we didn't know. So we're like, we tell patients 3 hours or it's free. Well, when we had 2 million members, we were getting doctors to patients in 12 minutes nationwide, except Florida, where it was like 2 minutes because the doctors were racing. And of course, it was always a race, but there was two doctors that were always competing. And seeing how fast they could get to the patient.
It's a great service in Florida. 12 minutes is lightning fast, but 2 minutes. I got to believe this informs, I mean, I know there's so much meat between here and there. Mm-hmm. But I bet you that also probably informs even how you think about Recura, right? With like, this has got to help a lot of the preventative maintenance, so to speak, that we probably as humans wait till things are really bad before we get in there, right? It's just now kind of a no-brainer to go, I think something's up. Let me pop a call real quick.
Yeah. Okay. So what did we accomplish with Teladoc? Teladoc is what we call reactive care. I'm sick. I need to talk to a doctor.
Yep.
Right? And so we created the whole new efficiency paradigm so that 2 minutes in Florida. But do we have the ability now to stay ahead of the curve? The way I like to think about this, because I have a 17-year-old now who at 8 years old got diagnosed with stage 4 leukemia. Leukemia is super dangerous and it's like, we're doing karate, we're climbing mountains, we're doing all these things. He doesn't feel well. We go to the doctor and it's what? Stage 4? What happened to 1 and 2?
2 and 3. Where do those go?
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, in our reactive care system, we don't do anything until we're sick. The doctor, the system, the technology that we have doesn't capture any data until we're sick and we go in. And so is it possible to create a preemptive system? And so what we did at Recura was we said, yeah, we can do it. And, we did. In fact, we did it so well that we're less than 2-year-old company and we've got 5 Fortune 50 customers.
Operating on the platform?
Yeah. Wow. Our first year of revenue was $8 million of top line. You know, we're going to triple that this year. And one of the worst economies we've had, what, in decades?
Right.
We're going to triple last year's revenue.
Impressive.
We will probably start January with something like $50 million of contracted revenue. January is our 2-year birthday.
Oh, Mike, so you're not even 2 years old.
No, we're not 2 years old.
I mean, you know, if anybody were to pitch that, I don't care how the technology is, anybody would be like, you're joking, right? Did y'all think it was going to do that good?
No.
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 But you love when that happens.
but we dream big, you know. And so everybody knows, you know, a unicorn is a company that's worth $1 billion, right?
Yeah.
And we said, yeah, the heck with unicorn. We want not a decacorn, which it would be 10, but a tridecacorn, which is 30. So that's our target is, you know, but in reality, I think this is another disruptive that takes the telemedicine concept to the next level. You know, how do we now capture data from every single device we can and put it into a system that does AI? And, you know, if your Apple Watch captures something unusual, let the AI know. The doctor looks at it and goes, this is weird.
Yeah.
Calls you on the phone and says, hey, you know, I see something happen yesterday. What's going on? You know, let's not have people go in and get stage 4 diagnosis. That's dangerous and expensive. And so our job now is to figure out how to get rid of the dangerous and expensive by making it less expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're doing.
I'm sure I know there's a lot to it, but I know how it differentiates conceptually, mm-hmm. but the tactics of it, is it mainly a platform with Recuro is the main thing about data collection, or is there also servicing that happens on that platform as well?
Yeah. So, you know, we have to be capitalists. And if we just started with, oh, we're going to fix all these things, we'd never get any customers.
You'd be like alive for 3 days. Yeah.
And so what we said was, okay, look, we built the telemedicine industry.
Yeah.
Let's go out and build a new version of Teladoc that's better than Teladoc. And so we started there so we can get revenue there. But at the same time, we're sitting in telling these major corporations, this is what we can do for you. And, you know, we'll do it better than Teladoc or whoever you're using right now, but add in all of these new things that we can start bringing your key employees in so they're not getting sick as often. You know, with Teladoc, we said, when they get sick, we'll get them turned around faster. And now we're saying, we'll do that. Plus, more and more, we'll catch things before they become expensive and dangerous.
Oh my God. I mean, one of my thoughts in this thing was like, how do you keep in the game on this, especially as such a behemoth kind of industry that this is? But after hearing you talk about it, I get why this is interesting. Not only is it good for the world, it's great for capitalism, but it's also really just, I mean, it's very intriguing, I imagine, to be seeing around corners that, like, you know, we were talking, Michael and I, before the show, were talking about First Ascents, and like, yeah. It's a hard thing to do, to go find a mountain or go find a side of somewhere in the world that's high that hasn't been climbed before. And so I find this, you're probably feeling like you're doing these First Ascents all the time in this biz.
Well, okay. So everybody who has a PhD has done a First Ascent.
Yeah.
Because in order to get your dissertation, you have to find something that hasn't been done before. And so you want to find the raw material, go find PhDs, because they've all done it at least once.
That's a great piece of input. Yeah. Like, how do you go find those ideas? Well, okay. I know there's a book that's probably going to capture a lot of it. Are you allowed to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah.
At all?
Okay. So let's talk about it. So about 6 months ago, I called Jay Sanders, the father of telemedicine. And by
such
the way,
a great title.
We
does he like that title?
Yeah, no, he doesn't.
I bet you he doesn't.
And so he and I are now writing a book. And in the book, we debate about it. Because he says, really, Dr. Bird created the idea. He's the one who came in red-faced. And you know, my position is this. Yes, Dr. Bird did create the idea. But he didn't do anything with it. He built one little system. It worked for him. It made his life easier. That's all he cared about. Jay carried the torch for it. He's the one who went around planting the seeds. He planted the seed at the University of Texas Medical Branch that Dr. Brooks felt and brought to me at Kilimanjaro. So, you know, these things, they fit together. But so, you know, what I tell Dr. Sanders is, if you think about humans, we have birth fathers and sometimes we have adopted fathers. You know, Nelson Mandela had an adopted father.
Yeah.
Look what he became. And so, yep, maybe Jay didn't create the idea. I didn't create the idea of telemedicine, but we created a $250 billion industry. And Jay didn't create the idea, but without him, the seeds that created Teladoc would never have happened. He carried it. He raised that child. And so I called him and I said, hey, Jay, let's write a book. And he said, great. And he said, how's that work? Because I've never written a book before. And I went, well, I've done seven. And we're going to write this book in 8 weeks. And he's like, what? And I go, every Tuesday, we're going to get on the phone and we're going to do a chapter. And we're going to do 8 chapters. And we just finished chapter 6 yesterday. Today's Wednesday. Last night, we finished chapter 6.
How long are these sessions?
What?
How long are these sessions on a weekly basis?
Well, what we did was we brought a ghostwriter in.
Smart, yeah.
And because neither he nor... He doesn't write. I write, but I don't have the time.
No, yeah.
And so what happens is we sit and we do 90 minutes in a session. It gets recorded. The ghostwriter just knocks it out. And she sends it to me a couple days later. And then I go in and homogenize it.
Yep.
And then Jay makes sure all the facts are right from his perspective. And so, yeah.
So the book is going to be...
October 11th is our final review of the eighth chapter. And Mark Victor Hansen, the guy who did Chicken Soup for the Soul, is going to... he's going to put it on the press for us. And November 1st, we'll have a book. I don't know the title yet. We're still debating that.
Has that happened traditionally in other books that I know you've done and you have some bestsellings out there? Like, do those books, does the title usually come first? I know it's an aside, but I'm fascinated. The title come first most of the time, or do you find that it's at the end that you go, okay, this is what fits?
For me, the titles came first.
They did, yeah. We start with the poster of the movie first, right? Yeah.
Yeah, but this is, you know, Jay and I have to come to an agreement on it.
Yeah.
I actually don't know. I mean, it's weird that we're in chapter 6 and we have 2 chapters to go and we don't know the title yet. So if anybody listening has an idea.
is it more, I don't want to give away the juices, but like, is it war stories kind of thing, or is it more like the like a how-to you got there or both?
So for me, it's a couple of things. You know, I talk to people that work at Teladoc now, and they don't know any of those stories. That DEA story, you'd think everybody at Teladoc would know.
Yeah, especially in that community.
But nobody knows the stories behind. So part of it is telling the stories. But as I was explaining, you know, this whole book to one of our salespeople who's very intuitive, and she said to me, wow, what you're doing is really writing the book. Because we're telling the stories from the past. How did we disrupt healthcare? But the last chapter is what's next. And that's really Recuro. And so we're taking Jay to Teladoc to Recuro. And how is Recuro taking this concept of telemedicine and turning it into a digital medical home where we keep people healthy? We, you know, one of the things that we say all the time is, the things that we will do to keep you healthy are the same things that will give you longevity. And so one of our advisors at Recuro is a man named Jeff Gladden, former cardiologist, now probably the preeminent longevity physician in the world. And Gladden says all the time, within 10 years, he's going to make 100 is the new 30. And so you and I are both athletic, and so we sort you'll get this. What Gladden says is, when he says 100 is the new 30, he's not talking about a decrepit person walking around with a crane. He's with a cane, not a crane. Yeah, the crane would help too.
Keep you erect and keep you moving straight back.
What he's saying is, if you were running 10Ks in your 30s, you're going to be running the same 10K times at 100.
That's what I'm talking
about. So, yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
I mean, heck yeah. I tell folks, that is what, that is my life. Y'all have to do this then.
Yeah.
So you're stretching this DNA out a little bit to make this happen, yeah?
Well, there's a lot of things, you know. So Gladden is also writing a book, which will turn longevity on its head
when
he releases it in January. But it's the way he says it is, we are an amalgamation of a bunch of different things. So you could be athletic and have good, strong heart and lungs and, you know, leg muscles. But if you have a hereditary heart issue and that ticker fails, boom, you're dead, right?
Yeah.
And so you're also as strong as your weakest link. And so Gladden's perspective is we can fix the weakest links if we know what they are.
Yep.
And so let's go out and create the tools so we know, is it your heart? Is it strokes? Is it cancer? Is it diabetes? What is it? Let's fix that one. And then once that's done, let's find the next weakest link and fix it. And so this mosaic of all the things that make us, you know, if I say, how old are you? You'll go back to your calendar date. But in a few years, we're introducing a new term called biological age. And if I say, how old are you? You'll say your calendar age and your biological age.
Oh my God, I cannot wait. That's going to be competitive.
And I already know mine. So,
oh, you do?
Yeah, my biological age is 7 years younger than my calendar age.
Oh my goodness, man.
And so, you know, those things are what we will bring to the fray. But it's not going to be a pill you take. It's going to be 30 things that you do, you know, on a regular basis to stay healthy and strong.
Go figure, right? I mean, everything good in life takes work, and there's a lot of things moving in it. Do you think that this is at all, I'm sure you've heard of the blue zones around the world and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the folks in those blue zones, for our listeners who don't know, there's five blue zones, I think, in the world. Those zones usually have folks' lifespans that are 25 to 30% longer than the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. You know, they range from places in Greece all the way to Costa Rica and then all over in Japan, I think, has got some, but got one. Do you think those folks are kind of doing some of the things you're talking about unintentionally?
Yes.
Like they don't even know that what they're doing is what they're doing. Because I actually visited one of those places before. It was Nicoya, Costa Rica. And what I learned there that, they weren't doing any injections or anything like that.
Yeah.
I think my gut told me when it was there. I was like, I remember talking to my wife and saying, it's got to be a few things that they don't even know mm-hmm. they're doing that's stretching their life out.
Yep.
You know, and so, and I imagine that's hard to replicate unless you know what the heck they are.
They don't even know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And now we need to turn it into a science. So, and it's different things in different places.
Yeah.
So the nuggets are out there. We just have to put them together. But in the world of the biological science, there's something called the Hayflick limit.
Okay.
And the Hayflick limit comes from the 1950s. There was a scientist whose last name was Hayflick, and he was studying mice. And what he realized is the life of a mouse is a function of cell division. So, you know, when it's young, their cells are dividing on a regular basis, and they slow down, and then they're all out of cell divisions, and then they die.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he realized was the number of cell divisions in a mouse is the same in a dog, is the same in a, name your mammal, including humans.
Yeah.
And so the Hayflick limit is now a number which is different for a mouse or a dog or a human. And the Hayflick limit in humans, and so I'll reiterate what it means. How many times will our cells divide before the biology starts saying, slow this down, we're almost down to the end, is the Hayflick limit. And what we figured out in the 90s was there's a little end cap on the DNA called the telomere. And every time our cells divide, the telomere gets shorter and shorter and shorter. And then when it gets to a certain shortness, like somewhere in our 40s, the body starts going, whoa, slow this thing down. And that's why we start getting wrinkled and things, because when we're in our teens, 20s, 30s, our cells are still dividing on a regular basis and, you know, everything's functioning well.
Yeah.
And then once you get to your 40s, depending on your personal biology, it starts slowing down. And so it's those cells that you had in your 40s that you're kind of stuck with, 50s, 60s, 70s.
Got to make these rations last, right?
Yeah. And so can we impact the length of the telomere? That's one thing that we're working on. And the answer turns out to be yes. We figured out ways to do that in mice. And how much does that impact everything else? So there's so much really cool stuff going on right now.
So I got to ask then, as an entrepreneur, like, do you ever find yourself wandering to other business ideas or things you want to start? Does this keep you pretty well on track? You know, how do you as an entrepreneur operate in that regard?
Yeah. So you want to fail? Start chasing every, remember the movie Up?
Yes.
Remember that dog in Up?
Yeah.
Every time I saw a squirrel, it ran after the squirrel. Unfortunately, entrepreneurs tend to be super creative people.
Yeah.
And there's a strong tendency to do exactly what you said. I'm working on Rekiro. Oh, what's that cool thing over there? I'll go chase it, you know? And if you do that, you're going to fail. You've got to stay, you've got to pick your target and stay focused on it.
How did you learn that at all, through some hiccups, or were you kind of always pretty disciplined in that?
Remember my story about engineering school?
Yeah.
The valedictorian, salutatorian. This one was chasing that. I hated it. I was at the University of Texas. You go in the library you're 19 years old. You're a male. Your hormones are crazy. You see all these cute girls going by. And I just hated it. It was like, I've got stuff to do. You know, I want to put blinders on so all I can see is my books. You got to stay focused.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can get to some end point where, you know, Teladoc has reached, okay, sweet. New team mm-hmm. has taken the baton. Now it's time to, it's mm-hmm. incredible advice. I do think that when I see someone with the title serial entrepreneur and not only the title, but rightfully earned, you immediately think, oh, that person's a buffet. They do a little bit of everything.
Mm-hmm.
They might do a little bit of everything is what I've learned, but they're probably not doing it super well, you know, if they are at all, you know? And so I do find that a lot of that has to do with that discipline that you probably learned through those bumps and bruises along the way.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that if you're building your version of Rekiro, that's the only thing you do. Think about a target and an archer.
Mm-hmm.
So if the archer wants to hit the center of the target, they have to be absolutely focused. You know, from pulling back to releasing to the arrow hitting the target. And you have to think about your work world the same way. If the archer just stands there all day long and does nothing but releasing arrows, then their fingers are going to get tired. They're going to get distracted. So you have to do the things in your life that balance. But you also have to remember, I'm the archer who always wants to hit the center of the target. In order to do that, I've got to focus on the target.
Yeah, I dig it. And it's easier said than done. I can imagine where there is there any things that you do, you may not, with being such a seasoned pro at this, you may not wander as much, but any advice you have for somebody who is like, I know, Michael, but you know, I got to do this other thing, or I got to do these other two things. Is there any things that you do to keep yourself centered other than probably just a track record of saying, well, when it worked well, it's because I was focused.
Remember Leonidas said the opposite of fear is love. And so if you remember what's behind you, if you're building your version of Rekiro, for me, I have investors, I have employees, I have people who are expecting this to be successful. And they're the love, they're the thing behind me that I am constantly saying, yep, I want to be distracted over here, go climb this mountain, go have this new beer, whatever.
Yeah.
But what I really need to be doing is remembering I'm stopping those Persians from getting to the guys behind me. And
yeah, no, it's a, appreciate the analogy. I think that's super helpful. It gets people kind of honed in pretty quick.
Yeah, it does.
Speaking of love, I'm curious, you seem to have a natural gravitation towards giving back. When I go into these things, I'm very well aware, these things being the podcast or whatnot, I'm very well aware how busy we all are. And especially so fortunate to have guests like you to be able to talk to. But I know y'all's stuff is dialed in. These things have to be planned out, and we're moving the train, you know? But you spent the first half hour just chatting about not only just life and stuff, but also just picking my brain and helping me think through some things and whatnot. I appreciate that. But that's not a me thing. I know that you've done that for many of folks. It's probably why, you know, in being involved with the Texas Business Hall of Fame as a director, I got to believe you mentor a lot of up-and-comings and folks that are already in the biz. How do you make time for it, or how do you prioritize that? Because you clearly do, you know, and I'd love to maybe just kind of hear how that works for you in your life. How do you fit that in?
I'm going to tell a story that doesn't sound like it's on point, and then I'll make it go on point.
Sounds good.
So in 2004, one of my sales guys at Teladoc said, I know Buzz Aldrin, so I'm a space buff. Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon. I know this with Neil Armstrong in 1969. And I'm like, I want to meet him. And I did. We became friends. And I asked Buzz to serve on my advisory board. And so this is going to go back to my engineering story a little bit. So why a guy who walked on the moon serving on the advisory board of Teladoc? And the answer is because there wasn't a person on the planet who wouldn't take his phone call, right? And the reality is you cannot do this on your own. You have to have resources. It doesn't matter. When I was younger, I thought I can work my way through anything. And then I realized the guys who grew up wealthy, who had the Rolodex card of all the wealthy people, they were accelerating past me so fast that I couldn't keep up with them. And in reality, it becomes a tool to help you move forward. Mm-hmm. Buzz was an amazing, and I did things for Buzz all the time. He did things for me. Now go back to Nathan Morton, who was my mentor at Internet Global, the Target, Home Depot, CompUSA guy. The thing he said to me is, Michael, I will help you because somebody back there helped me. And your job, once you become successful, is to find people who you think are going to be able to take those leaps and help them. And I'm always looking for those people now. You know, he planted that seed in me, and I see the value of all these people that helped me move forward. Isaac Newton said, if I've seen farther than most, it's because I've stood on the shoulders of giants. Yeah. And that is so true, you know. So you you will do this, you know. Your shoulders will be the place where somebody stands. And everybody listening, you know, when you get successful, that's what you need to be doing.
Just giving back. So it's more of a less of a. It does feel good, but just hearing you talk about it, it's almost a duty, right? Like to be able to push that forward. Otherwise, this whole thing we call business and making the world like just goes away. Mm-hmm. You know, long after our 120 years on the planet, after Ricuro figures that out.
Oh no, we're gonna live beyond 120. That's our goal.
Where are you finding yourself most of these days, you know, giving back within either Texas or whatever with you know, young and up and coming folks and stuff? I'm sure that they are picking your brain a ton.
Well, I love the Texas Business Hall of Fame, you know, and there, as you know, there's an amazing person there named Meredith Walker who,
rock star.
She's a rock star. And so that's a great place because if you think about it's so many different things. So you're a recipient, you know, that scholarship. Let's find those people who are going to be the next members of the Hall of Fame, the next legends. And so what a great concept. It gives us a tool. My back to space thing, that is so much fun. You know, I get to work with the Apollo astronauts. And
so epic.
I know. It is.
I mean,
really
did
epic.
You ever think that was going to happen?
No. I didn't.
I mean, okay. So
I was a poor kid. I mean, my dad was a sergeant. Come on. We were, when we lived in D.C., we lived in the ghetto.
Oh, my God. Yeah. No doubt you guys were barely making it there. I don't care what kind of stipends the military gives you. It's not going to cover it.
I am just old enough to remember Neil and Buzz walking on the moon. I never would have guessed one of those two guys would become my friend. And you know, Mike Collins, who was orbiting around, I got to spend a lot of time with him as well. And so I never met Neil Armstrong, but the Apollo astronauts, we got time for a really funny story?
Of course we got time, yeah.
So the first American in space, Al Shepard, right? Mm-hmm. He got grounded right after his mission because he had a Meniere's disease. And so for most of the 60s, when all of his buddies were going up into space, he was on the ground. And he found a doctor that would cure it. And so NASA gave him Apollo 14. Okay. And the granddaughter of Apollo 14's command module pilot, the guy that orbited the moon, that was Stuart Roosa. His granddaughter is Danielle Roosa, who's the founder of Back to Space, a company that I'm also a founder of, right? And so I get to hear all these great stories. Oh, so, man. Okay, so they go to the moon, right? Stuart Roosa lets the little command module go, and Al Shepard and Ed Mitchell go down to the surface of the moon. They do all their stuff. Al Shepard builds a golf club on the moon, hits some balls, you know. And so anyway, they go do their stuff on the moon. They get back in their module. They come back up to outer space where Stuart Roosa is orbiting around. They dock, okay? And once they're docked, Roosa has to open the door. And he doesn't. And Shepard is like, and Roosa goes, "Who is it?" Well, I can't say on the air what Shepard said next.
I can only imagine. I mean, I can imagine the nerves going through his brain right now. Please open the hatch.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
The back to space whole initiative and you know what you found it at the end of the day, what is it other than, of course, it's a perpetuation of your love and passion as a young kid and stuff, mm-hmm. and things that a lot of people are interested in now more than ever. But how do y'all best serve folks in that biz there and what you guys are doing?
So actually back to space is a capitalist endeavor.
Yeah.
And, right now the team is building these pop-ups. And so they're going to have an experience where you go in, you put a headset on, and you'll be like a character in a movie, but you're the main character.
Yeah.
And you've got a mission, and all of the other people that are around you, maybe people you know, maybe actors, but you're now on the moon and something broke and you got to get it fixed.
Yeah.
And so those things are called pop-ups, and they're the next generation to going to the movie theater and seeing a movie, except now you're in it. And everything around you is so real that you really get lost in it, like the young kids get lost in their video games. And so that's an opportunity to teach, make money, and inspire.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's got to be the juices that get folks going. And we're probably closer than ever on being able to make this way more mainstream than I think folks had in the past, right?
Oh, yeah. It's here. The first one that Backspace is building is called Lunar Light. And I think early next year it'll start touring, and
all over,
all over the country.
Oh my goodness, yeah,
and then multiple languages and all around the world.
Oh well, I can't wait. You said next year it'll be kind of breaking. Well, that's going to be epic. Yeah, I can't wait to go see what that looks like, and especially when you get, before I think you say it as a kid or whatever, astronauts has got to be up there in the top five jobs kids say they want to be, right? But more than ever, like, it's a real doable thing. And probably in a way that, you thought about, people thought about flying at some point, or whatever the case might be. So that's really great that you're doing that. Is it based here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area as kind of HQ or?
Actually right here in this building.
Really?
This is the home of Back to Space.
That's what I'm talking about.
It's a pretty streamlined organization. Danielle Roosa is located in LA. Matt Thompson, who's the president of the organization, is in Austin.
Yeah.
But there's a big project that's going to get built in Jacksboro, right outside of Dallas.
Oh my God. Okay. Well, this is a great spot for it. I mean, I know we're here in a few minutes left, and I appreciate your time. I wanted to end it off with asking, and I think it's a good lead into it with, there's a lot of great things happening in this state. And I think from the outside looking in, it can seem, I had with one of the founders at Desert Door, Soltail Company, great, great spirit, saying that it can be seen with like some kind of arrogance, from the outside looking in, like, I am those Texas folks, they're always just drinking their own Kool-Aid and think they're all great. When folks kind of come into the borderlines, they realize like it's a really giving place. People want to see you win. And the sport of business is kind of how I think about it. Like, I want to compete with the best, right? And so I want to do everything I can to make sure that when I win, that I know I was winning against the best people that I possibly can. But at the same time, it's just really cool to see people come up. And you mentioned something several times during this talk that, surrounding yourself not only with good people, like in the business, but also good people. I mean, every time we've, talked to each other there, Michael, you've always recommended, here, dear friend of mine over here, or someone is doing great. You almost talk about other people more than you talk about yourself. What advice would you give to somebody who is on this initial journey, maybe you've been on it for a while and it's kind of stuck, but looking at it and saying, I got a great team and stuff, but maybe I need that outside resource. I need some other peers to kind of, or maybe seniors to help me out. How did you find that in the early days? Where now it seems that you've built an incredible group of friends that are in the same sport together and you help each other out. Mm-hmm. I know that, you know, talking to Jason there at Vary the other day, y'all are, you know, mm-hmm. close. And it's just cool to see that circle.
Yeah.
And y'all really are rooting for each other. How do you build that? I mean, where does that come from?
So the world of entrepreneurs is tighter knit than you might think. And there are organizations around the state that tie entrepreneurs together. The Capital Factory is in Austin and Dallas.
Yeah.
And it's a great one. The Health Wildcatters and the Tech Wildcatters up here in Dallas, another great organization. So that's a good place to start.
Yeah.
If you're an entrepreneur, you're doing it for the first time. Once you've built something successful, everything changes for you. And when I sold Internet Global, there was a guy named David Zumwalt. We had an incubator in Richardson called StarTech. And David was early on at StarTech. And I remember him saying to me, I asked him, "Oh, you know so-and-so. Could you introduce me to him?" And he said, "Well, he wants to know you." And I go, "What?" And he said, "You built a successful company. Mom told you, go get your degree because that's going to open doors for you. The number of doors that get open after you build a successful company are infinite." And I use that all the time. If I want to meet somebody, I just pick up the phone or email or just polite persistence until I get them.
Yeah.
And you'd be surprised. I mean, you can get to anybody on the planet that way if you've got that credential. You know, just like, if you want to get an engineering job, first you get the engineering degree, and then you start applying for the engineering jobs. But so step one, get into an incubator where you're surrounded by people who can make connections for you and short circuit your path. And then the next thing is, once you built that successful company, be unbashed. You can get into any door then.
That's
just
amazing.
Be polite, persistence.
Polite and persistent. Yeah, don't take no for an answer, but do it the right way with the manners that you need behind it.
Right.
Michael,
right.
Thank you so much for this time today. I know that the way that you're also helping just business and folks, you know, even like myself around the world, is something that folks are much appreciative with. And I do think that I am stoked to see the things that you and your team are going to be doing here at Recuro. I'm not only personally invested in just seeing, like, you know, let's see how you make this world better, but it's cool to see a team doing it who actually is looking like they're having a good time.
Yeah.
You know, not one that's just like trudging through the mud, just being like, we got to do this, you know, type thing. So thanks for all you do.
Yeah. Thank you for all you do. You know, keep doing it and let us know how we can help.
Will do. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate
you
it. Well, thank you all for listening. This is the Professionally Offensive Podcast. You can catch us on all platforms. JC out.